Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Well Women Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Laura. Today, I am talking about something that I get asked a lot in my practice by my patients, and rightfully so. I'm talking about everything that's safe and contraindicated in pregnancy. And so I'm just going to talk about a lot of the common ones that come up in terms of nutrients and herbs. In pregnancy, it is understandable. Lots of people are scared to take things, rightfully so. And they should be because there are a lot of things that aren't safe. And so I'm just going to preface this episode with allowing you to understand that when we are doing research and we're looking at the safety of anything, the best quality of research is looking at randomized controlled studies. And so what that means is they would actually take two groups of people. One group would do X intervention, the other group would do nothing, and then they would basically look at the outcomes in terms of what happened. And that would allow us to see safety, that would allow us to see efficacy in specific nutrients. And now, if we take that principle and we apply it to pregnancy, you can understand how it is completely unethical to do that in pregnant women. We certainly can't be taking half pregnant women and the other half pregnant women and giving them a certain intervention and saying, or withholding a certain intervention and saying, okay, now let's see what happens. So that is why a lot of things you'll see will say insufficient data, because a lot of the research when we're looking at things that are safe in pregnancy are based off of what's called retrospective data. So they will look at women, they will survey women, and they will say, did you take this during your pregnancy? Did you do this during your pregnancy? And if the answer was yes or no, they would look at outcomes and they would see what they find. And if they find patterns, then we can sort of make those connections. But the data is not great when it comes to pregnancy. And that's with respect to herbs, that's with respect to nutrients, and that's with respect to medications. So don't think that everything that they recommend in pregnancy is completely safe. Most of the time, they just haven't found any poor outcomes in terms of miscarriages or fetal deformities or malformations or things like that. And a lot of the time, they're looking at, or all of the time, they're looking at a risk-benefit scenario. So we're always looking to say, okay, if I give this treatment, is it going to outweigh the negatives of not treating? And so that's what we're always looking at in terms of pregnancy. So a lot of women suffer from various ailments during pregnancy. It is a tough time on your body. And so what I'm going to go through this episode is really talk about my prenatal must-haves, so nutrients that you have to be on. I'm going to talk about some of the research in other nutrients with respect to certain conditions or ailments, certain herbs that commonly women will either ask me about or commonly women will take in pregnancy, and then kind of go from there with respect to talking about comparing and contrasting different treatments. So I will say that I'm going to, in this episode, talk about a lot of the research and what certain nutrients or certain herbs were found to help with. I'm going to talk about any ones that were found to be completely contraindicated, but I will not be mentioning any dosage information. And that's just simply because when you are pregnant, no matter what the body of evidence says, we are always looking at you from an individualized perspective. So if you want to take something or you think something would be good for you based on the information that I'm giving you today, always, always, always speak with your naturopathic doctor, your medical doctor, or your midwife to see if that would be a right treatment for you, because there always are exceptions to the rule and there's reasons why or why not, or why you wouldn't be taking something. So to jump right in, I want to talk first about prenatal must-haves. So these are my nutrients, my non-negotiables. When I am treating a pregnant woman, I want to make sure that they are on these things. So the first one is a good quality prenatal supplement. And I just want to go on a little bit of a tangent in terms of prenatal supplements, because there is only one prenatal supplement professional brand that I recommend. And I'll tell you about the reasons why. So the reason why I recommend this particular one, the one I recommend is by NFH, and you can only get NFH through a naturopathic doctor or through specific health food stores, but usually it's behind the counter. And so the reason I like the prenatal through NFH is because, number one, the dosing in each nutrient is a really good dose. Usually when we're looking at prenatals, we're looking at 3 capsules a day. You really can't get around that. But the dose of each nutrient is really, really a good therapeutic dose. Secondly, looking at the form of the nutrients, and these things I'm listing right now, you'll probably find in any professional prenatal, and I will highlight why I like this one specifically. But when we're looking at specific forms of certain nutrients, the ones I really look at are folic acid and iron. And the reasons I look at that is because when we're looking at iron, a lot of women and a lot of people in general who take iron, one of the major side effects is digestive upset. And a lot of times we get constipated, we get diarrhea, and that's already an issue in pregnancy is constipation. So I find that that's actually a big barrier to women being able to take their prenatal vitamin is the constipation and the side effects they feel, usually, which is because of the iron. So when we're looking at iron in a prenatal supplement, we need to make sure it is iron glycinate, because that is a very absorbable and less constipating form of iron. So iron glycinate is what you're looking for. And iron bisglycinate, so it's iron glycinate or iron bisglycinate, has been shown to be superior in absorption and bioavailability to other forms of iron. Specifically, it was reported to be 3.4 times greater than that of ferrous sulfate. And when we absorb it better, that actually reduces the gastric irritation and the constipation. And so that's a really, really important thing, is making sure your iron is not something that's going to cause you more symptoms, because ultimately you're taking the prenatal so you can A, absorb the nutrients, and B, not have side effects. So if we have a constipating form of iron, that's not going to be helpful at all. So iron's the first thing. Folic acid is the second thing. And this, you've probably heard, any woman who is in childbearing age, so you could potentially get pregnant, needs to be supplementing with a form of folic acid. And so low folate levels in pregnant women have been linked to birth abnormalities. You've probably heard of neural tube defects, and that's the reason why we supplement with folic acid. Now, looking at the form is extremely important when it comes to folic acid. So folic acid is basically what we have from, it's the synthetic form. So folic acid is the one that's used in our fortified foods. It's used in our dietary supplements, whereas folate is what is found in foods. And now that's a big distinction. So unlike folate, which is found in foods, folic acid, the majority of it is actually not converted into its active form, which is known as 5-MTHF. MTHF, which is methyl tetrahydrofolate. So long word, basically that means it's the active form of folic acid, active form of folate. And so your body basically needs to convert, if it's taking that synthetic folic acid from a supplement, it needs to actually convert that to 5-MTHF. And so the problem with this is a lot of times our body isn't doing that. So number one, we're not absorbing it. And then number two, we have all of this unmetabolized folic acid. And several studies have actually reported the presence of unmetabolized folic acid in blood following the consumption of either a dietary supplement or a food that's fortified. And not only are we not absorbing it, but one of the major risks associated with excessive intake of folic acid is the development of cancer. So all this unmetabolized folic acid can actually be harmful. So when I'm looking at a prenatal supplement, I'm looking at products that contain 5-MTHF on the label, no questions asked, because we don't want one that says folic acid. And now, having said those two things and talking about those two nutrients, I wanted to look quickly at a few more common prenatal vitamins that you can just get over the counter. The first one I'm looking at here is the Jamieson brand. And so when I'm looking at it, I'm finding folic acid, like I said, not in the form that we want. It's just folic acid. And then their iron is fumarate. Again, not a greatly absorbed one, not a greatly bioavailable form of iron. And so, I mean, right off the hop, I would say you're not going to be absorbing the two major things that I had just mentioned. So I wouldn't even go with one of these. And then I'm looking at a really common one by Nestle called Materna. You've probably heard of it. This one has folic acid as folic acid. And it also has iron as, again, ferrous fumarate. So not a well-absorbed form, probably causing constipation. And the other thing that I want to mention is all of the non-medicinal ingredients. And so when we look at our supplements, we are always trying to find the least amount of extra ingredients. And usually these ingredients are made or are added in rather to make the capsule or to assist in emulsification of the nutrients. There's usually a role, and there should be a role. Beyond that, we are adding in things in order to most commonly preserve. So when we're looking at the non-medicinal ingredients, Materna has things like BHT, shellac, soybean oil. There's gelatin from bovine and pork. So honestly, that would be something. Oh, and cornstarch. So if you are sensitive to any of these things, soy, corn, then you could actually be having a low-grade inflammatory reaction to something like this. Another one, I'm not sure of this brand, but I just found it online. Again, folic acid as folic acid and iron. This one is iron as amino acid chelate. So I'm not actually sure what that is. But the reason I wanted to highlight this prenatal is because it actually has an added organic fruit and veggie blend, an organic liver support blend, and a digestive support blend. And now there is something to be said about that being okay. However, with the liver support blend, there are herbs like ginger and artichoke. And when I get into the safety of herbs, we'll kind of talk about why I wouldn't want anything extra. So if you see a bottom line, if you see a prenatal vitamin that has herbs on top of all the nutrients, I would say just stay away from it, because go with the basic, make sure you have the right folic acid, make sure you have the right iron, and make sure there's not a lot of extra crap. The last one I'm looking at is a one-a-day women's prenatal. And this one was, so not only does it not even say the form of iron, it doesn't say the form of iron, it doesn't say the form of folic acid, which we can just assume is just folic acid. But the thing that bothered me about this one is that it had red dye number 40, red dye number 40 lake, yellow number 6 lake. And so we don't really need lots of food coloring in our prenatal. So if you see food coloring, I would say stay away from it, no matter what the forms of anything else are in it. The last reason why I like the NFH brand is because it doesn't have vitamin A or beta carotene. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about vitamin A in pregnancy. You will find it very, very difficult to find a prenatal vitamin without vitamin A or beta carotene. So there are reasons why I don't like that, but this is a great, good quality prenatal, and I'm not worried about it having vitamin A or beta carotene. Yes, vitamin A is required in fetal development, but there are just reasons why I don't deem it necessary in the prenatals that I'm recommending. So that's that with prenatal. Second non-negotiable is a fish oil. So whether you are vegetarian or you are not, that's going to be an omega-3. So that can be in the form of flax oil, or it can be in the form of a fish oil. And then again, making sure we're getting a high enough dose, making sure we're getting a form that we can easily digest and absorb, and just making sure that it's one that we can tolerate well. My third non-negotiable is probiotics. The research is forever growing on probiotics and prenatal use of probiotics and the outcomes in babies. Two things I wanted to highlight is probiotics can be associated with improved glucose and lipid metabolism in pregnant women, which can actually help with the reduced risk of gestational diabetes. So if that's something that you're worried about, this would be good to be on. I find it also helps with the constipation, helps moving the bowels daily. It also reduces the risk of asthma, the atopic triad in babies. So asthma, eczema, atopy, and allergies. So probiotics are, again, a non-negotiable. Finding a good quality probiotic, I use the NFH because in pregnancy, we really, really, in any part of life, we want to make sure we're taking good quality, high quality supplements. But when we're in pregnancy, we specifically want to make sure that we are taking high quality supplements and not settling for less where we can have additives and preservatives and things like that. Vitamin D is my last non-negotiable. A deficiency in vitamin D in pregnancy has been associated with low birth weight and preterm birth, and as well as increased risk of MS and type 1 diabetes later in life in the baby. It's important for in utero development of the immune system, the lungs, the bones, and teeth. Also, other research has shown that increased maternal vitamin D intake during pregnancy might have a protective effect on asthma and wheezing in children. So again, the prenatal that I give has vitamin D in it. However, I usually am supplementing a little bit more depending on the person. Vitamin D is one of those things that it's good to get tested so that we can actually see what your levels are at, and then we have an accurate way to dose appropriately. Because vitamin D is fat soluble, you can't just take as much as you want and be fine, contrary to probably what you hear. So those are my non-negotiables during pregnancy. Next, I'm just going to talk about the safety and efficacy of specific nutrients, ones that are used often, and then we're going to go into herbs. So first off, talking about vitamin A. So I mentioned that I always choose a prenatal without vitamin A or beta carotene, which is also a form of vitamin A. And so the reason why, so research has shown that 10,000 international units of vitamin A in the first 6 weeks of pregnancy has been associated with birth defects. And that goes for literally any form of vitamin A. For those who have been on Accutane, that's very high dose vitamin A. You're always advised not to get pregnant and to actually wait for a period of time after you're off of Accutane before you try and get pregnant. And that's the reason why. However, they are unsure of the teratogenic effects, if there are any, under 5,000 international units. So we know over the dose of 10,000, we know that we've seen teratogenic effects. Under 5,000, we don't know. And so the research says that vitamin A is likely safe when used orally or intramuscularly and appropriately, safe during pregnancy and lactation in doses less than 10,000 international units. However, possibly unsafe when used over 10,000 international units, can cause fetal malformations. Excess dietary intake of vitamin A has also been associated with teratogenicity. The first trimester seems to be the critical period for susceptibility to vitamin A-associated birth defects, such as craniofacial abnormalities, abnormalities of the central nervous system. Pregnant women should monitor vitamin intake from all sources. Forms of vitamin A are found in several foods, and I will talk about those foods. And unlike vitamin A, beta carotene is not known to be teratogenic or lead to reproductive toxicity. So you can see how the research is a little bit unclear when it comes to vitamin A. It is clear that over 10,000 international units, we know causes an issue. But we also know that it's from all sources. It's not just from the supplement, it's also from food. Also, beta carotene is not known to be teratogenic. So in my opinion, I usually choose a supplement that has neither vitamin A nor beta carotene because I know that my patients are getting enough vitamin A from their diet, and I don't want them to have to worry about calculating all their sources of vitamin A throughout the day in order to be in that safe zone of consumption. So I'm going to give you a few foods just to give you an idea of how much vitamin A is in foods. And now from foods, it's absorbed a lot better. And so we don't have to worry about it being straight vitamin A. A lot of foods just come in the form of beta carotene, but this is the amount of international units that are in food. So a sweet potato, one whole sweet potato, has about 28,000 international units. Beef liver has about 22,000 international units, and that's about 3 ounces. Spinach, frozen, boiled, half a cup, is about 11,000 international units. Raw carrots, half a cup, is about 10,000 international units. Pumpkin pie, one piece, is about 9,000. Cantaloupe, half a cup, is about 4,000. Sweet peppers, half a cup, is about 3,000. Mangoes, one whole mango, is about 2,000. So you really get the idea. Broccoli has half a cup, has 1,200 international units. So you can really see how really easy it is to get vitamin A from your diet. Really, it's about just eating fruits and vegetables. If you had a bit of spinach every day, you'd be good. So in my opinion, I don't give a prenatal that has vitamin A. I specifically don't give a prenatal that has vitamin A, but some people might give one that has beta carotene, which could make very, very logical clinical sense. In my opinion, personally, I don't give that one, and that's why I give the NFH one that is vitamin A and beta carotene free. You'll notice that in some supplements, they actually have both vitamin A and beta carotene. So you need to make sure you're looking at that as well, making sure that you're not having too much. So that's what I will say about vitamin A. Now, vitamin B6. So vitamin B6 has been found to be safe when used orally and appropriately. And actually, a special sustained release product that is vitamin B6, 75 milligrams, has been approved by the FDA for use in pregnancy. And it's actually considered a first line treatment for nausea and vomiting in pregnancy by the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. So, vitamin B6 is a really, really great nutrient to use when you're having nausea and vomiting in pregnancy. And usually, so vitamin B6 on the flip side there can be concern with a high dose maternal intake that can cause neonatal seizures. So again, we need to make sure that we're taking the right dose and we're not overdoing it. More is not better. And so usually in severe nausea and vomiting in pregnancy, women will be prescribed something called Declectin. And so I just wanted to compare and contrast vitamin B6 versus Declectin. So vitamin B6 is just a form of B vitamin. Like I said, the 75 milligram daily tablet, usually you'll do it in divided doses, has been approved for use in pregnancy and has actually been shown to be quite effective. Declectin, I really wanted to highlight the ingredients. So Declectin is a combination of vitamin B6 with an antihistamine. And then the non-medicinal ingredients are, and I'm just going to list a few of them, but we have red number 27, blue number 2, we have PEG 400, we have propylene glycol, we have titanium dioxide, shellac glaze, we have carnauba wax powder, so ammonium hydroxide, lots of additional ingredients that, in my opinion, are there to help with nausea and vomiting. We don't need blue number 2 or red number 27 to reduce our nausea. And again, adding colors and dyes are not safe. So I would say that I would actually choose a vitamin B6 over Declectin. And if vitamin B6 didn't work, then I mean, again, we're looking at risk benefit scenario. If you have something like hyperemesis and you were vomiting all the time and your doctors are concerned about dehydration and Declectin works for you, then you take it. I am just simply giving you the information and helping you compare and contrast what I've seen in the research and what I'm looking at in terms of extra ingredients and things like that. Vitamin C is an interesting one. And a lot of these nutrients I'm listing are actually in sufficient doses in your prenatal or in the prenatal I'm recommending, rather. But some of these you can dose higher, and that's going to be at the discretion of your practitioner, so of your naturopathic doctor or of your midwife, in order to decide whether or not you need more or you can take more than is already provided in your prenatal vitamin. Vitamin C has been shown to possibly prevent premature rupture of membranes through collagen synthesis. So premature rupture of membranes is basically, simply put, it's going into labor early. So you're kind of losing that plug when you shouldn't be. And it also can help increase bowel movements in constipation. So again, constipation, we have probiotics, we have vitamin C. Between the two of them, your bowels should be moving. In pregnancy, it is safe orally, but not used when in excessive doses. Tell patients not to use doses exceeding 2,000 milligrams a day for pregnant and breastfeeding. Higher doses can actually cause diarrhea and gastrointestinal upset. So, I mean, it says not to use over 2,000 milligrams. Like I said, I'm not going to give a specific dose, but you could technically use more if going for the osmotic effect and the diarrhea, not the diarrhea, but looser stools was your goal in someone who's severely constipated. So that, again, is going to be a risk-benefit chat that you have with your naturopathic doctor or with your midwife to ensure that what you're taking and the dose you're taking is adequate. Then looking at a systematic review, which is a great body of research, they looked at 29 trials. This is about 25,000 women, and they found women supplemented with vitamin C alone or in combination with other supplements versus not taking anything. They were at a decreased risk of having a placental abruption, and they had a small increase in gestational age at birth. So those are all good outcomes with vitamin C intake. Zinc, again, you'll find this in your prenatal, decreases the risk of low birth weight in babies. It's needed for protein synthesis, DNA metabolism, or DNA forming, sorry. It helps prevent congenital malformations, especially in the central nervous system, and it can actually assist in preventing neural tube defects. One that I find really interesting is magnesium, and magnesium has some research on it with respect to magnesium is important in pregnancy in general, but there is some extra research additionally to suggest that magnesium is actually good to help with common concerns in pregnancy. So compared with placebo, magnesium supplementation in women with gestational diabetes actually resulted in a decrease in levels of fasting plasma glucose. So again, if you are someone who is suffering from or at risk for gestational diabetes, magnesium might be a good thing to supplement. Again, it's going to be in your prenatal, but additional supplementation would be at the discretion of your practitioner. Magnesium supplementation was also associated with significantly fewer babies with an Apgar score less than 7 at 5 minutes, late fetal heart decelerations. So basically, these babies came out healthier. Women receiving magnesium were also less likely to require hospitalizations during pregnancy. Another thing I found really interesting, so lots of women suffer from leg cramps throughout pregnancy. And so they took women weeks 14 to 34 of gestation who had leg cramps at least twice per week. The study period was for 4 weeks, and they basically had women take magnesium, and then they had women take nothing. They found that the oral magnesium supplement could improve the frequency and the intensity of the pregnancy-induced leg cramps, and that this would be a good treatment option. Okay, so that's really the nutrients, and basically I wanted to highlight the common ones that are taken additionally and ones that should be in your prenatal. There's going to be a whole slew of nutrients in your prenatal that there's a reason why they are there. But I wanted to highlight a few of the important ones and a few of the ones that you can start a conversation with your healthcare provider if you feel like you want to supplement more or you feel like you could benefit from supplementing more of any of those. Now, when we jump into herbs, things are going to get a little bit different because, like I said, the research really isn't there for a lot of herbs. Some things to be aware of. When we're looking at certain herbs, food sources are likely to be okay. Number two, look at what else is in your supplements. And so when I was talking about that supplement that added in the greens, they had a liver protect, they had a digestive blend, I would not take that supplement because I would want to be speaking to my healthcare provider and making sure that the herb that you're taking is safe in pregnancy, effective, and at the right dose. And so I wouldn't just take one that's blended in with a prenatal. Look at your powders. If before you got pregnant, you used a greens powder, if you used a protein powder that was like a protein plus, look at your powders, look at the things you're already taking in your life, and make sure that we're not having these additive herbs, or we're having these herbal blends of things that we don't know if they're safe in pregnancy or not. When it comes to herbs, less is more. And when in doubt, don't take it, especially in the first trimester. Unfortunately, the first trimester can be rough and we get sick and we are constipated and things are changing and we might be getting headaches and acne and things like that. But when in doubt, don't take it because it's either not studied enough or not safe. And so just to run through with herbs to avoid completely in pregnancy: sage, cinnamon, fenugreek, pennyroyal, thyme, and licorice. Those are ones that I would say that's a no-go. These are known as potentially harmful during pregnancy. I would not give these at any stage of pregnancy. Information is unavailable on a few herbs, and that is borage, cumin, black seed, and a few others that you probably wouldn't be using, chicory. But again, this is a gray area. Not enough information is known, so I would actually just stay away from them. Herbs that are seen to use with caution: oregano, greater plantain, and basil. And then herbs that have been shown safe to use in pregnancy. Now, I'm going to say this, preface this again with, I wouldn't just go take these. These are herbs that are shown to be safe in pregnancy. However, I'm going to go through some of the research that might suggest otherwise. So the ones that are listed: garlic, aloe, eucalyptus, olive oil, coconut oil, green tea, chamomile, ginger, peppermint, and anise seed. So those are ones that are in the list of safe to use in pregnancy. And so I want to actually go through a few of the specifics. And actually, we'll just start with echinacea, because there is actually a product out there and it is meant for taking when you're sick. Echinacea is great to help with your immune system. And so it actually states on the product that it's safe to use during pregnancy. However, when I looked at the research, I personally didn't find it convincing enough to make a recommendation. And so again, when it comes to herbs, you need to make a recommendation. When it comes to medications or herbs, you need to make an informed choice based on the risk-benefit scenario. Like I said, they're not going to take pregnant women and give half of them echinacea and not give half of them echinacea and see if the half that took echinacea ends up with birth defects, because that's unethical. So usually what they do is they ask women what they did. Okay, so the general consensus on the research in pregnancy, it comes up as possibly safe when used orally short term. There is preliminary evidence that mothers can safely use echinacea in the form of echinacea purpura or echinacea angustifolia, solid dosage forms, tinctures, and drops daily for 5 to 7 days during the first trimester of pregnancy without adversely affecting the fetus. Until this is verified by high quality research, advise patients to avoid echinacea. So you see how the research is very much contradicting itself. It's saying we think it's fine, but the research that we think is showing us that we think it's fine isn't actually that good quality of data, so hold off. And so I found a study in the year 2000, and they found that echinacea products were the most popular phytomedicines used in North America. Women are likely inadvertently using echinacea in their first trimester. And so basically this study wanted to evaluate the safety when it was used in women inadvertently. So they basically took the notion that a lot of pregnancies are unplanned and a lot of women are probably using it inadvertently, and they're seeing what happened. So they looked at women who were followed up after contacting Mother Risk regarding the gestational use of echinacea. And so they basically looked at the rates of minor and major malformations between the groups. There was a total of 206 women in the study, and they found that 112 women used the herb in the first trimester. There were a total of 206 women. There were a total of 195 live births, 3 sets of twins, 13 spontaneous abortions, 1 therapeutic abortion. 6 major malformations were reported, including 1 chromosomal abnormality, and 4 of these malformations occurred with echinacea exposure in the first trimester. So, looking at that, if I'm saying if there were 6 major malformations and 4 were in the echinacea group, and then in the control group, there were 7 malformations reported. So it was hard for them to look at there was no statistical difference between the study and control. So based on that information, you could say it was fine. But again, to me, it's not that convincing. And it was in the year 2000. So it was 19 years ago. Then there was another study I looked at in 2005. Basically, they showed that short-term use of echinacea is associated with a relatively good safety profile with slight risk of adverse events. While reactions tend to be rare, patients with certain allergies should avoid the use of echinacea, and the use of echinacea products during pregnancy and lactation would appear to be ill-advised in light of the paucity of data in this area. And so that was a 2005 study basically concluded that there's not enough data, it's not good enough, and we shouldn't be recommending it. So you can see how it's very conflicting. What I would say is A, speak with your midwife, B, speak with your naturopathic doctor if you feel like echinacea is right for you. But I would say, honestly, when in doubt, don't take anything, especially in the first trimester. So maybe if you feel like echinacea would be something that you would benefit from throughout your pregnancy, it would be a really good idea to talk to your naturopath, talk to your midwife about taking it in the second trimester where possibly the risks are less. The biggest problem is exposure during the first trimester when everything is developing. I would say risk-benefit scenario, if you're trying to help with a cold or something else, the cold is not impacting your baby and the echinacea might. So again, risk-benefit scenario, it's got to be an informed choice and you need to be advised by somebody who knows what they're talking about and knows how to find the research. So this is why people tell you, some people say take it, some people don't, because I mean, like I said, the data shows there was no statistical difference in the women who took it versus the women who didn't. However, do we want to take that risk? And that's really up to you and your healthcare provider. Garlic. So I mentioned above, garlic was in the green category of being safe in pregnancy. And so I had it in the green from one study. And from other research, it actually says it's likely safe when used orally in amounts commonly found in foods, possibly unsafe when used orally in medicinal amounts. Garlic is reported to have abortificant activity. One study also suggests that garlic constituents are distributed to the amniotic fluid. However, there are no published reports of garlic adversely affecting pregnancy. In clinical research, garlic 800 milligrams daily was used during the third trimester of pregnancy with no reported adverse outcomes. There is insufficient reliable information available about the safety of topical garlic use during pregnancy. And so based on that, I would say eat garlic in your food and don't worry about it. If you are going to take garlic or if you need to, a lot of times we'll be doing garlic as a treatment in small intestine bacteria overgrowth, or we'll be doing to help with bloating or gas, or we'll be using it to help with the immune function and not getting sick. Again, I would say hard no in first trimester. In clinical research, it was given during the third trimester with no reported adverse outcomes. I would still say stick to garlic in food and that's it. And then beyond that can be discussed with your healthcare provider. Looking at the research in ginger, one study I looked at talked about ginger versus vitamin B6 versus placebo. And now here we're talking about nausea and vomiting. And so again, that's a common concern. And so they basically did a triple blind clinical trial on pregnant women who had mild to moderate nausea and vomiting between 6 and 16 weeks of pregnancy. So this was actually in the first trimester. In these women, they gave ginger twice daily or vitamin B6 twice daily, or placebo, and this was for 4 days. And then they evaluated the severity of the symptoms. And so nausea and vomiting was evaluated before the study and then after the 4 days of use. And they actually found that ginger was more effective than placebo and was comparable with vitamin B6. So I mentioned vitamin B6 as an option for nausea and vomiting, and now I'm mentioning ginger as an option. And the last thing I mentioned was Diclectin. And so what I would personally do is, if I was suffering from nausea and vomiting or my patient was, I would actually recommend starting with B6 or ginger. If that didn't work, flipping to the other one, so B6 or ginger. And then if that still didn't work, then maybe looking for a prescription like Diclectin. Ginger was also shown to be more effective than acupressure. And then the other research I've seen, again, showed no difference between B6 and ginger. So they were both shown to be effective when it came to nausea and vomiting of pregnancy. And it was also associated with no fetal risks at taking ginger. And the trial done by Mother Risk looked at ginger at doses of 250 milligrams 4 times a day, and there was no fetal risk. So the ingestion of ginger for nausea and vomiting was shown to have no harmful maternal or neonatal effects. Looking at chamomile. Chamomile is something that a lot of women will drink in tea form, a lot of times take for an upset stomach or anything like that. And so I wanted to look at this recent study. And again, in the research I looked at on that study where I was looking at the green good herbs in pregnancy, chamomile was listed as a safe in pregnancy. In 2015, they did a study. Basically, women were called to be interviewed 3 days after birth, and they were asked about their habits during pregnancy. And so they found that the women who reported regular chamomile consumption actually also were shown to have a higher risk of preterm delivery. They had lower birth weight babies and lower length of the newborn. They also found, on top of chamomile, the regular use of fennel resulted in a shorter gestational age, so women had babies sooner. And so you can do what you want with that information. Again, it's not high quality research, because all they're doing is, think about it, after 3 days after you've given birth, you're being called up and you're being asked about your chamomile use during pregnancy. And number one is if you remember correctly how much or when or whatever else you were actually having. And number two is that if it's actually related. So they basically pooled this data and they said, based on the fact that these women used chamomile, they looked at how their babies were born and they basically made correlations. So some research says it's safe, some research says it's not, some research says that there's insufficient evidence. And so based on that, again, I would say don't use it during the first trimester. I would say infrequent use if you're speaking with your healthcare provider and they think it's an okay thing to take in the second and third trimester. I wouldn't have it every single day. And then with constipation, again, I've talked about probiotics, I've talked about vitamin C. And basically, the research shows dietary forms of fiber, so bran or wheat fiber, have been helpful in constipation. Doing like a seed blend can be helpful. Adding in some chia seeds can be helpful, just getting the bowels moving. But like I said, probiotics, vitamin C, magnesium at the right doses can also help move your bowels. So bottom line is to make sure that you're always talking to your medical doctor, your naturopathic doctor, or your midwife when it comes to any of these things. My goal was basically to educate and to give you an idea of why we are so conservative when it comes to dosing in pregnancy, treatment in pregnancy, and really why you can't take a whole lot of things in pregnancy. So I will end it on that note. If you have any questions, feel free to send me an email, laura@laurapiper.com. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review so that I can keep delivering these episodes for you. And send me any feedback on any topics that you'd like to hear in the future. I'm always open to that. Thanks, guys.